The year 1987. The artist, Public Enemy. The message, turn it up, bring the noise. And if you live in an American city, it probably feels like everything around you took this message literally. There's nonstop construction. Irritated drivers stuck in traffic. Planes flying overhead. And don't think you can just escape to the burbs, because I mean, have you heard those leaf blowers? Turns out that all this noise is a very real Public Enemy.
Here we go again.
For decades, scientists have been sounding the alarm on noise, specifically noise pollution. As far back as 1978, former U.S. Surgeon General William Stewart said, quote, calling noise a nuisance is like calling smog an inconvenience. In the decades since Stewart's warning, multiple studies have underscored the hazard that noise pollution poses to our health and environment. I'm Melissa Harris-Perry, and we begin today with a whisper instead of a bang, because we're talking noise pollution on The Takeaway. We're joined now by Rick Neitzel, professor of environmental health sciences at the University of Michigan. Professor Neitzel, it's so great to have you here.
Thank you. It's wonderful to be here, Melissa.
All right. So what do we mean when we say noise in this context? How do you define noise?
Noise historically has been defined as simply unwanted sound, which can take many, many forms, of course. More recently, a group of, advocates and researchers have begun using a definition that's a bit more inclusive of health impacts. So now we would say noise is unwanted or potentially harmful sound, noting that even if sound isn't annoying, it can still be harmful to your health.
Give me an example of sound that might be harmful to our health that we don't necessarily acknowledge or recognize as annoying.
Well, certainly we can have sound in the background from road traffic, air traffic, rail traffic, construction sites that may not rise to the point of annoyance, but could still be potentially loud enough to harm us. Certainly many of us work in noisy workplaces, and we may not find that noise annoying, but that noise can absolutely be harmful as well.
Now, what are some of the main sources of noise pollution?
For communities in the U.S. and indeed around the world, the sources I mentioned a moment ago, so road traffic, traffic from airplanes overhead, rail traffic, construction, those are the four predominant sources of noise, at least in terms of annoyance. But we also have to recognize that there are other sources out there that are relatively unprecedented in human history. For example, wind turbines are a source of noise that are emerging and are quite appropriately being installed for green energy and sustainability, but represent, again, a type of noise source that really hasn't been in human existence beyond the past few decades.
Oh, so that's interesting. So something that we might be installing or engaging for the purpose of actually improving our environmental conditions could also have unintended negative externalities, harms that we didn't mean for them to have?
That's absolutely right. And I'll give you an example. So I think most people recognize that urban density is necessary for sustainability. But on the flip side, the more dense our urban environments become, the noisier they tend to become. So there's an active trade-off there between increased sustainability and increased noise. And for this reason, I would advocate for greater focus on noise. So we want to, of course, increase sustainability, but we don't want to have other health impacts come along with that, for example, due to noise exposures.
So you're speaking here primarily about urban environments. This was kind of a conversation as we were putting sort of this research together, and much of the team of The Takeaway lives in cities. I happen to live in a kind of, you know, smallish city, somewhat more rural environment, much less dense. Is this a problem also in suburban and rural environments?
Much of the research that's been done historically has focused on urban environments. And as you probably know, in the year 2008, 50% of the global human population lived in urban areas, and that number has increased since then. So urban areas have been a focus because it's where the majority of humankind dwells. And certainly there have been many studies from myself and other researchers around the world documenting that urban areas do present high noise exposure potential. The problem with rural areas is not necessarily that they're quiet, but just that we have not studied them. So you might imagine that a rural environment could in fact be quieter. Maybe it has less road traffic or less air traffic noise, but it might be, for example, that rural residents are more likely to have a noisy job, say in agriculture or construction. Mm-hmm. So it may be that they have the same exposure, it's simply coming from different sources, perhaps from work instead of from the ambient environment.
All right, I want to talk about one more aspect of the ambient environment, and that is electronics. And, you know, recently we had a hurricane, you know, kind of on the back end of a hurricane, we had a power outage, and I was stunned at how quiet the house suddenly, I mean, sounded without the refrigerator, without the computers, without any of the devices being plugged in, and I suppose making this buzz that I don't normally notice. Is that just annoyance, or is that part of the noise pollution equation?
I would say that's absolutely part of the equation. We did a study, some colleagues at Columbia University and I, back in 2012 in New York City, looking at different sources of noise exposure. And we found that for the majority of people, music from electronic devices was actually their predominant source of exposure. And so there is this potential for perhaps levels to reach high enough to cause hearing loss from listening to music. But you're absolutely right. We also have this constant background hum around us, not from personal listening devices, but from the refrigerators and other electronic devices. It tends to fade into the background. We sort of cognitively screen it out until, as you point out, we're faced with a scenario where the noise is no longer there, and then it's absence becomes quite obvious, as you've noticed.
Why hasn't noise pollution gotten the same level of attention as other public health concerns?
That's a marvelous question. I would say, or at least my personal opinion, is that because noise isn't associated with lethal effects, we don't think of noise as causing cancer or other sort of very dreadful health outcomes, we've tended to ignore it. Now, noise absolutely does cause debilitating health outcomes. I think Americans, somewhat uniquely in the world, tend to write off hearing as being an important sense, but in fact, it's critical, and hearing loss is a debilitating health outcome. I am hopeful that as our epidemiological understanding of the impacts of noise exposure expands, we will start to recognize that actually noise is very strongly linked now to things like high blood pressure and heart attacks and stroke. And it's increasingly linked to mental health and psychiatric disorders and potentially things like diabetes and preterm birth. So while noise historically has been easy to ignore because, again, it doesn't cause us to bleed, it doesn't cause diseases that at least in America we view as being unacceptable. Now that we're starting to recognize, hey, some of the top killers of Americans, like heart attacks, like strokes, actually are linked to noise, I'm hoping that we can raise its profile and get it to be considered sort of on par with air pollution and water pollution, which also, of course, are quite important forms of environmental hazards.
We're talking right now about noise pollution with Rick Neitzel, professor of environmental health sciences at the University of Michigan. So, Rick, when you say that that it's linked, right, that noise is linked to these variety of outcomes, whether it's diabetes or heart disease or preterm birth, is that link at this point correlational, or do you have at least a hunch, a hypothesis around some arrow of causality? How would noise exposure be connected to, for example, heart attacks and strokes?
From an epidemiological perspective, there's a couple of things we look for here. One is we want to have different study designs to look at these associations, for example, between noise and cardiovascular effects. We also want to look at different human populations. And ideally, we do want to establish causality. And the good news here, at least from a research perspective, is there is a host of evidence, both correlational, as you suggest, but also causal, where we look at the development of health impacts over time as people are exposed to noise. And the summation of that evidence is such that I think there's a pretty convincing link here that not only are these things associated, but that in fact noise is causing them.
Are there policy solutions? Are there ways to intervene?
there are absolutely policies. Examples here would be, for example, regulations on how much noise can legally be permitted to be emitted from sources like cars and wind turbines and things along those lines. There are physical changes we can make to the infrastructure. We can start using, for example, quieter pavement on roads. We can make increased use of barriers on the sides of roads. We can do, as the Federal Aviation Administration has already done, regulations that lower by law the noise that can be emitted by jet engines. We can educate consumers and the public to help protect themselves and be aware of the risks of noise. So lots of different options. No one of them is going to be a silver bullet. We probably need to implement all of them. Really, all that's lacking is this point. At this point, I think, is the recognition that noise is, in fact, an important problem and the political will to actually do something about it.
When I hear you say one of the things we could do is create policies that limit the amount of noise that can be emitted, my gentrification hackles go up and I think, what if one community understands, and particularly given what you said about music before, right, understands some kinds of sounds to be deeply connected to who they are and to their culture and their community, and another group perceives it as noise. How might we, in a policy context, manage that challenge?
It is a challenge. You're absolutely right. One person's music can absolutely be another person's noise. So I think this is something we need to tread on very carefully. I'll also highlight there are many situations in the U.S. where a community has moved in or as you say, gentrified in an area that already had high noise. And then once they've moved in, realize, oh, this noise is offensive to us. So I think there are absolutely cultural issues here. I'm thinking of examples of housing developments sort of growing in around a shooting range or an airport and then becoming disturbed by that noise. So to the degree that sound that's out there is desirable, certainly we don't want to take that away. My argument is primarily to eliminate things like construction noise and transportation noise rather than music, which has such huge cultural importance. So I think there do need to be considerations there. Again, I'm not advocating that we need to move to a silent environment by any means, but I think you're absolutely right that these factors need to be considered so we can thoughtfully design and implement policies, again, that are designed to protect health, but not just to suppress noise that makes people joyful, for example, like music does.
Or like the takeaway. Rick Neitzel is a professor of environmental health sciences at the University of Michigan and is not advocating for the end of radio. Rick, thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much.
Hi, everybody. I'm Melissa Harris-Perry, and it's good to be rocking with you today. Now, come with me to Washington, D.C. Car wash jumping rims, they shining up. To a corner in a historically black neighborhood in D.C., just a few blocks away from Howard University. And there you'll find a Metro PCS phone store. You'll know you're in the right place when you hear the go-go music bumping. Let's have a barbecue. Grab your phone. Everybody go call the blue. Let's have a block party. Now, the store sits on the corner of Chuck Brown Way, which is named after the godfather of go-go himself, Chuck Brown. These days, gentrification is a defining feature of the Shaw neighborhood, which is likely why in 2019, a resident in a luxury apartment building across the street from this Metro PCS store made a noise complaint. The resident allegedly threatened to sue the owner of Metro PCS, which is T-Mobile. So the go-go was turned off. But the community turned up. The Don't Mute DC movement was born. Here's Tony Lewis, a community organizer, speaking to the Washington Post during a pro-go-go protest.
And we all got to work together to ensure that this city can't be its greatest self without the DC native, without go-go music, without mumbo sauce, without communities, right, that have helped establish what this city is.
Here with me now is Natalie Hopkinson, Associate Professor of Communication, Culture, and Media Studies at Howard University and co-founder of Don't Mute DC Movement. Welcome to the show, Natalie.
Thank you for having me.
Can you tell us a little bit about what GoGo means for that corner in DC?
That corner is the most magical, wonderful place in all of DC, because that is the place where outside this store that GoGo is playing from 10 a.m. to 7 p.m. And if you just drive, if you're driving by that corner, you might hear, you know, ambulance sirens because the hospital's across the street, but you'll also hear the music and you'll see people doing impromptu street parties. There's lots of dancing, lots of people having a wonderful time. And why someone would want to turn down that wonderful time, I have no idea.
Well, what do you think about why someone would want to turn down the GoGo?
I think that they don't understand when you hear it. You know, the way I liken it is to being on one side of a cell phone conversation, right? You're just hearing one side of what's going on. And in the GoGo, you're actually, it's a communal call and response concert. It's a live music. You know, the audience is talking back to the people on the mic and they're participating. They're part of the band. They're participating in it. And so the recordings that you hear is really just a recording of it. It's not the actual thing. But a lot of the people who you see stopping to dance, they know what the real thing is. And so they can appreciate it. And those people who don't know what it is, and, you know, there's thousands of Howard University students who are not from DC and didn't grow up in the tradition. But somehow we've gone 25 years without them trying to turn off the music. More like a lot of the students that come in will ask a question, oh, what is that? And somebody will tell them, oh, that's GoGo music. And, you know, they'll learn about all this incredible history and what this whole, how it speaks to Black identity in Washington.
So share with us a little bit of that history. Where does GoGo come from?
So as you mentioned, Chuck Brown is the creator of GoGo. He created it in the 1970s. It's a cousin of hip hop, very much funk based. There's a lot of Afro-Latin rhythms, you know, which he's picked up playing with a band called Los Latinos. And it's very much Black diaspora music. If you hear it, you could be anywhere. You could be in Lagos. You could be in Kingston. You could be in Washington, D.C. So it's wonderful, like Black diaspora music. This is extremely pervasive for Black Washington. And the fact that white people of most stripes, whether they're new or old, many still today don't know what GoGo is. And that really speaks to how segregated our city has been historically. And of course, with gentrification, that's changing. So communities that didn't interact before are interacting, and you get these culture clashes like we saw at that store.
Yeah, let's say a little bit more about that, because, you know, as I was reading about all of this happening, it occurred to me that it connects to this sort of long story that even historian Robin D.G. Kelly gives us about Black folks sort of retaking public space that they're losing in terms of housing, in terms of businesses, but they retake it in terms of sonically, right? They retake it culturally. And I'm wondering about sort of how Black DC, once Chocolate City, is feeling about these demographic shifts and gentrifications.
One of the great things about the DC movement is that I think there's been this narrative for a long time that Chocolate City is dead. You know, those Black days are over, as my mother-in-law said that about New Orleans, right? Those Black days are over. But what the movement showed is that it is possible to reclaim, you know, and to sort of hold your ground and say, we are not going to be pushed away. So a lot of people often told me, like, of all the things that people could take to the streets, and people did take to the streets, you know, as you heard of that clip with Tony Lewis, thousands of people took to the streets to defend this corner and to defend GoGo music. And people said, well, why would people do this for music? You know, why not march for jobs and healthcare? And what I always tell people is that it is jobs and healthcare. GoGo music is intertwined with all parts of Black DC. It's intertwined with all of that. And so, you know, to sort of see this being able to push back against you know, very powerful people, very powerful corporation that were wanting to silence Black culture and Black people, you know, it sort of gives people a lot of hope.
Natalie Hopkinson is Associate Professor of Communication, Culture, and Media Studies at Howard University and co-founder of the Don't Mute DC movement. Natalie, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
You come to the New Yorker Radio Hour for conversations that go deeper with people you really want to hear from, whether it's Bruce Springsteen or Questlove or Olivia Rodrigo, Liz Cheney, or the godfather of artificial intelligence, Geoffrey Hinton, or some of my extraordinarily well-informed colleagues at The New Yorker. So join us every week on The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.
I'm Melissa Harris-Perry, and this is The Takeaway. 30 years ago, in 1991, Condé Nast launched a monthly women's beauty magazine, Allure. Now, you might think Condé Nast is all Devil Wears Prada click-clack girls.
Andy, you look so chic.
You look so thin.
Do I?
Just one stomach flew away from my goal weight.
But from the very start, Allure pushed the boundaries and broke the rules of women's magazines, offering diverse, edgy, and impactful content that has kept Allure relevant for decades. Last month, Allure broke ground again, naming Jessica Krull as their first Black woman editor-in-chief. Now, Krull is a longtime beauty editor and founder of Allure's Black beauty-centered The Melanin Edit. Jessica Krull joins me now. Jessica, I just have to ask, how did it feel when you were promoted to editor-in-chief?
Well, you know, it was a very interesting process because I've actually worked with Allure for the last 2 years. And so I was definitely a Condé Nast loyalist. I've been there multiple times before. This isn't my first time at Condé. So when Michelle, who I worked with closely and really admired, decided to move on, we had a lot of conversations about what the next iteration of the brand was going to look like. And either way, I was going to be there for it. And I think that I at first was a little hesitant to take the top job. I'm not going to lie. But I thought more and more about how much I have been able to do amazing work at the brand in my tenure there. And that just convinced me when I started to kind of come up with ideas to present to the hiring team, I just really felt that this was the right move for me. And I was so glad that it all worked out. And I'm so glad to be able to really bring those ideas to life as editor-in-chief.
Talk to me about the hesitancy. Is that about leadership in general, or is that about leadership during a time when legacy women's magazines are having all magazines, right, are having a tough time based on what the old model was?
So I think the hesitancy definitely wasn't about leadership. You know, I love to help people grow and grow a staff and really work with the team that I'm working with now is such an amazing team. So that wasn't the real hesitancy. I think I grew up wanting to be editor-in-chief of a magazine. It was my childhood dream. I've been pursuing journalism since I was in high school. I even made for my high school senior project a mini magazine with myself on the cover. It was you know, very vain of me, but, you know, so I've always dreamt of being in this role. But as you said about legacy media, when I first started in this industry, the feedback was, you know, learn digital, learn digital, learn digital. And so that's what I did. And it served me very well for my career. But then I had the opportunity to come to print and to come to Allure, which is a, you know, multi-platform brand, as all brands must be these days. And it was a dream come true. And I think for me, it was kind of like, this is too good to be true. Like, can I really be getting my, you know, 17-year-old self's big dream? And I was actually excited by the fact of being able to work in legacy media at this time when I think I have so much to offer to a brand that has been around for 30 years and has such an amazing history to be able to bring it into this digital first age and really think about all the ways that our brand can expand, like our store that we have in Soho, like our box that it delivers to people's house every day. So I'm really excited, actually. And I think, you know, jitters are jitters.
What role do women's magazines play in the larger landscape of coverage these days?
You know, it's a big business. You know, I think that's one of the reasons why I personally, you know, thought Allure was a good fit for me when I came back 2 years ago, is because we have many opportunities to reach our reader in many different ways. And being a leader across all those things, most days I'm, you know, taking a lot of notes and kind of keeping everything in mind. I think my job is to really be the connector between all those things, between our subscription box team and our editorial team and our creative team and the people who run our store. And I think being the person who's kind of guiding the vision at the top is something that is very important, right? Because every place you meet Allure, you want it to have the same feel. And so that is kind of what my role is. And I am the first Black woman to lead this brand. And I have been in touch with Linda Wells, who's the founding editor-in-chief. And I have obviously worked closely with Michelle Lee, who was the editor-in-chief after that. So I'm really excited to kind of lead this brand and kind of tack on to the history that they already really brought in. So yeah, I'm very proud of all the ways that we show up in this world. And I think we're going to continue to do that. I think no brand can be one thing anymore. And I think that's what we're learning as the media landscape changes so quickly. There are very few brands that just have digital and print products. You have to figure out other ways to reach your reader. And, you know, social media is one piece of that, but we're a beauty brand and we are the experts when it comes to beauty. So how can we offer our readers that expertise everywhere that they are, every way that they shop, every way that they encounter beauty?
Speaking of all the ways we encounter beauty, can you tell me about the Melanin Edit?
Yes, the Melanin Edit is one of those projects that I got to work on that I was like, this is a dope brand that I got to create the Melanin Edit. I'm going to stay here. I like this.
I like it too, I got to say. Although I don't know about the I'm not laying my edges no more. I have a lot of feelings about it. We can talk about it, but talk about the Melanin Edit.
Yes. I mean, but that's what the Melanin Edit is for. It's to have those kind of real conversations. So the Melanin Edit was kind of birthed out of this belief from myself and some other members of our staff that, you know, those with melanated skin, Black women, brown women, Latinx women deserve a special place, want a special place to speak to each other. And I think our brand has done such a great job of covering Black women and women of color, you know, throughout our many different platforms. But the Melanin Edit is really just a special place for us. It's a place where we can have those really deep and sometimes confusing and controversial conversations. But the fact of the matter is our skin, our hair is different and therefore deserves that special attention. And so that's what the Melanin Edit became. It became this space that we could, the Black editors at Allure and some amazing writers that we admire could sit and speak about skin concerns and hair issues and just conversations around colorism that we really felt were important to have in an authentic way and a way that's true to the amazing joy that we have in our community.
When you say in part that Allure is the beauty experts, tell me then, what is beauty? What constitutes beauty these days?
So being the editor-in-chief of a beauty magazine, I think some would try to define beauty, but I'm the exact opposite. I truly believe that we can't define beauty because beauty is in everyone, in everything that we see. I think our job is to be the mirror to the world around us to display all the beauty that the world has to offer.
Stick with me here for a second, because I actually want to surprise you a little bit.
Okay.
I have somebody here to join our conversation that I didn't tell you about, but I thought it might really give us something fantastic in this conversation. So, Jessica Kruhl, I'd like you to say hello to Ms. Susan L. Taylor.
Oh, my goodness.
the, of course, legendary editor of Essence Magazine, who is now Emerita Essence Magazine Editor-in-Chief. Ms. Taylor, thank you for joining us.
You know, I'm so excited to be with both of you. You know how I adore you, Melissa. And Jessica, I'm so proud of you. And listening to the conversation between the two of you just gladdened my heart, because you really are looking at your role, I think, in the most nourishing, soul-nourishing way, to be a mirror, you know, to the world around us, that each of us is a divine original, and not to put ourselves in boxes and compare ourselves to one another.
Oh my goodness, I feel so honored. I feel so honored.
I want to give you an opportunity. I want to step back a little bit. If there is anything, given that you are stepping into this new role with this vision of being a mirror, if there's anything you'd like to either say to or ask Ms. Taylor.
Well, I just want to say thank you. I mean, I think I recognize that the only way that I'm able to be where I am today is because of the work of people like you, Ms. Taylor, who really created that space for us. You know, I grew up obviously reading Essence and Jet and Ebony in my home, and being having that platform for me to see myself made all the difference. And for me, it's important that I make you all proud. You know, I've been so happy to see all the, you know, the community outreach since I've been appointed, but I work every day to continue the legacy that you started. But I think I would like to ask, you know, what would your advice be for someone who is doing something in this digital age?
Well, I'm not the one to ask where it's going, but I can tell you imagery has never been more important, because what you have are people who can retouch their own pictures and add parts and make them larger or smaller. And then you have, you know, the folk who are watching this and who compare themselves to these images that are either real or retouched and feel badly about themselves. You know, beauty truly is in the eye of the beholder. And people can be taught to realize what is beautiful. And, you know, in this digital world, I think it's so important that we remind women that each of us is what I call a divine original. To me, that's the miracle of life, that there are how many people? There are, what, 7 billion of us on the face of the earth, and no two of us look alike.
Jessica Kruhl is the new editor-in-chief of Allure Magazine. I want to thank you for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
And Susan L. Taylor, you're going to stick around because we have a little bit more conversation with you. We've got one other person to bring in on that as well. But Jessica, again, thank you so much. And thank you for the work that you're doing at Allure.
Congratulations.
Thank you. So lovely to speak to you both.
Susan L. Taylor is still with me. She's editor-in-chief emerita of Essence Magazine and founder and CEO of the National Cares Mentoring Movement. I'm also bringing in here Dr. Monique Morris, CEO of Grantmakers for Girls of Color, a philanthropic organization dedicated to cultivating investments to support girls of color in the United States. Now, I want to speak with both of you about the importance of mentoring at the individual level for young Black girls, and also at the community level, so that they can have the foundation they need to succeed. Dr. Morris, let's start with you. Tell me the way that Grantmakers for Girls of Color is investing in girls rather than extracting from them.
At Grantmakers for Girls of Color, we are essentially a community of educators, organizing foundations and donors, and people we consider co-investors to mobilize investments in and about girls of color. We support organizations that are led by and centering Black girls and other girls of color through direct grant making, but also through capacity building. Since we launched the Love is Healing Fund last May, Grantmakers for Girls of Color has moved about $5 million to more than 180 organizations in 36 states, DC, Guam, and Puerto Rico, with the intention of supporting girls and girl-led movements in all 50 states by the end of the year. You know, our intention is really to shift not just the way that we move money in support of movements and organizations that are led by and in service to girls of color, but also to really think about how we shift narrative and policy and understanding to create a community that can be responsive to the specific needs of the young folks in our community.
When you talk about community, Ms. Taylor, I want to come back to you because, you know, I'm born in the early 70s. I remember distinctly my father giving me an Essence subscription when I was maybe 12 or 13 years old. Some of it went over my head, but the one thing that I caught for sure was that this was a community. This was a space. And I'm wondering, as you have moved certainly through the world of publishing, but now into this space around CARES, how you've understood the needs related to Black girls and other girls of color actually being able to build community, have some autonomy to create that space.
And you know, the girls, as Monique Morris often points out, are really ready to do that. What we have to do is ready us adults. We have to ready the community in their understanding that Black girls deserve to be heard. They deserve to be listened to. And, you know, they share with us that adults are very didactic. They point the finger, they criticize, and they don't listen. We have been doing work with young ones who've attempted suicide. And they said, if only you would hear us. When you see that we look sad, ask us what's going on inside. And so I would say that what we do, yes, we're creating community, and we're working with, you know, able Black women. We're working with women who are not struggling, as I was a single mother, even working at Essence, to keep food on the table and a roof over our family's head. We're trying to help Black women who have resources and who can make time, that they must make time for our young ones who really are struggling along the margins and need us, need our hands at their backs, so that they know that there are people who care about them and will help them to move forward. So that's the work that we're doing with the mentors we've recruited all throughout the country, hundreds of thousands of them.
So Dr. Morris, when I think about what Ms. Taylor said there about hands on the girls' backs, you're the author of the extraordinary book, Push Out. And so often when Black girls find a hand at their back, it's not to push them forward, it's to push them out. Help us understand why this is an issue for our institutions, even among our elders in our own communities. What are some of the barriers that we have to really listening to Black girls?
It was interesting earlier when you all were talking about retraining our eyes to recognize the beauty of Black femininity. I was thinking instantly about how important it is that we also retrain our consciousness to see Black girls and other girls and women of color through a lens of appreciation. And that is really what the Push Out, I would say, series or project is. It's about recognizing our Black girls as sacred and coming into a community together to respond in the way that demonstrates that we see that sacredness in them in all the ways, even when they're experiencing moments of disruption, even when they are too loud for our taste or appear to be combative. Our ability to see Black girls as something, someone sacred, invites us to approach them differently. It invites us to have a care so that our hands are pulling them in closer, especially when they're in moments of dysregulation, rather than pushing them away. I love that the CARES network is called CARE, because one of the critical points that has been elevated in Push Out, in Sing a Rhythm, Dance a Blues, or in any other conversation that I have with young people, particularly Black girls, is that they want to know that the adults around them care. And once they know the adults around them care, that's when they're receptive to learn from us. That's when they're receptive to building relationships with us. That's when they're receptive to understanding what it is that we have to communicate with them, such that they can grow and be well and thriving in their what we call liberated futures. So this notion of care is critical, and how we use our arms and our hands is essential.
Oh, this is, I love what's beginning to build here, what I'm starting to understand in terms of these connections. So Ms. Taylor, I am thinking about this when typically when we hear mentoring, And particularly if you're talking about mentoring from women of some level of means and capacity, that can sometimes translate into a kind of a fix the girls version of respectability politics. Come, ladies, and let me teach you how to sit with your hands crossed and your ankles crossed and how to be proper girls and ladies so that you can achieve. But that's not how you're seeing what's going on in CARES, right?
Not even a little bit. And in fact, the women you're describing, those barriers, the barriers of class, are really breaking down because of all the tumult in our country. And I think women who have seen themselves as apart from the struggling community are now realizing that their children, and very often they themselves, are as vulnerable as the folks whose lives we've seen taken on, you know, via video. So our training is specific to consciousness shifting. This is what we do. It begins with our heritage, understanding who we are, what we come from, and what we've been taught. We've been taught to hate ourselves, our hair, our lips, our hips, our color, everything about that comes from our motherland. That is the training up until the Black Power movement. That's really when the shift took place. And so you saw a Black Enterprise and Essence Magazine and so many advertising agencies, a new consciousness emerged. And it's one, I think, in fact, that has waned a bit. Colorism, I think it's as prominent as it's ever been. And this is another training, and this is what we're bringing to our young men and to parents. We have to teach girls to love their color and everything about their bodies, but we also have a lot of training to do with our boys. We have training to do with our boys that helps them to widen the lens. Black girls are feeling, many of them are feeling so rejected. And then the kind of pressure that it puts on girls of a lighter hue who say that black skin, dark skin girls treat them so meanly. And this has to do with who's most desirable. And I think breaking down that psychology, those systems, and explaining to young people how it emerged, what it really harks back to, a self-hatred, a hatred of everything that is African, with that understanding, the consciousness begins to shift.
Monique, we hear here Ms. Taylor talking about systems of oppression that are inculcated in so many aspects of our lives. And I know the mission statement of Grantmakers for Girls of Color is to resource and support transformative organizing that dismantles these systems. Can you give us a kind of concrete example of maybe one of your grantees and the ways that they are actually doing this transformative organizing work?
I had a conversation years ago with some young people, and I was talking to a group of Black girls, and I said to them, you have to remember who you are. And one of them said, but what if we never knew? Mm-hmm. Right. And so that, you know, broke me in a lot of different ways. And also, I think, invited me into a deeper conversation about how we get girls to see who they are and to engage in this process of discovery that can allow them to dismantle the multiple ways that oppression manifests in their lives through the systems and structures, culturally, individually, but also in the ways that they have internalized themselves. Earlier this year, we announced through the Black Girl Freedom Fund that there were 6 new grantees that had been selected by Black girls and femmes to receive our first round of grants from this fund. And it was a beautiful process to engage in and to recognize the power of Black girls and femmes coming together to articulate what's important to them and how they should move resources from this organization into community in a way that is meaningful. And we see that they supported organizations like Get Smart Before You Get Sexy, right? Which is inviting girls into a space of understanding what their value is before they spend so much time on the aesthetic. You know, the Hive Community Circle, so much of the transformative work and the recognition, or what I have often called the grand remembering project that we're in right now with respect to countering anti-Blackness and all the ways that that informs the multiple harms that manifest in our communities, is deeply rooted in our our ability as organizations, certainly within philanthropy, but also in the direct service organizations that are building power with our girls and femmes and other young folks through inviting them into and exposing them to new lenses for viewing themselves and placing themselves at the center unapologetically, which is hard to do in this society. So it's been a real joy to be able to resource organizations in this way and to challenge philanthropy to do the same.
Can I ask you, Ms. Taylor, over the course of maybe the past year or two, in some of the forced quiet space, what are the lessons that you were hearing and what are you acting on right now?
So this time has really taught me to surrender. To surrender to the things that I really can't change and to ask deeply, what have you come to teach me? What have you come to teach me? And to listen to that.
Susan L. Taylor, CEO of the National CARES Mentoring Movement, and Dr. Monique Morris, CEO of Grantmakers for Girls of Color. Thank you both for joining us today and for coming to teach us so much.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.
This week, we've discussed many of the reasons it's important to listen to and believe girls and women. So, Team Takeaway sent up a little cheer yesterday afternoon when we learned that Britney Spears is free. I mean, almost. On Wednesday, the judge in her case suspended her father as conservator and temporarily installed her accountant in that role. There's one more court date coming up on November 12th, and if all goes well, Britney's 13-year conservatorship could come to an end. Britney, we're listening, we're believing, and we will continue to follow up. That's all we have for you today, folks. And of course, call us about anything at 877-8-MY-TAKE. That's 877-869-8253. Or send us a tweet at The Takeaway. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Melissa Harris-Perry, and this is The Takeaway.